It's almost like they've built this moat around the industry that nobody can crack, right? There will never be some 18, 20-year-old in some garage or in their mother's den that disrupts real estate, because you got to have the experience. You got to have the background. You got to understand the problems, and because it's multidimensional.
Welcome to another episode of Tools, Talents, and Techniques. I'm thrilled to have a friend. I haven't spoken with him in a while, but I've been watching from afar all the great things that he's been doing and watching how hard he's been going at building his dream and making his dream come true. So I'm excited to welcome to the show Mr. Bobby Bryant. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, man. Thank you so much.
We have a lot to cover around technology, real estate, entrepreneurship, all the things that I love to talk about and I love to learn about. So before we jump into the deep end, could you please give a brief description of who you are and what you do?
You know what? I'm an optimist. I'm a dreamer. I'm a visionary. I'm all of the above. But, but I'm also a disciplined guy. I'm from Mobile, Alabama. Let's talk about the beginning. But from Mobile, Alabama, so I'm a Bama guy, roll tide, that probably burned a lot of ears. But anyway, been in Texas for what now, 25 years. I am a servant of people, bachelor's degree in vocational rehabilitation and counseling. I got a master's in special education, and I got a second master's in education administration to become a principal. Never did it, but my track record is one of serving people. Been in real estate for 26 years, absolutely love it. And therefore, we're here trying to figure out how to make the real estate industry more efficient and effective and human by way of technology.
I love it. Concise, robust. Let's go back to the beginning. When you're in Alabama and you mentioned that you're going to be a principal, was that something that you originally wanted, like growing up as an adolescent, as a teenager? Was that always on your mind?
You know, great question. My mom worked in the school system. And her best friend was a lady by the name of Mickey Ellis. And so when my mom worked at the school, and being that my mother, really caused me to be blackmailed a lot, so I couldn't get in trouble and I'd have perfect, conduct and grades because my mom was there. After school, I went to hang out with Mickey Ellis, and her kids that were special education. A lot of times I would ask that question and I was like, why? You know, a lot of people look at me and the last thing they ever would think that I would be a special education school teacher with kids with learning disabilities. But I think it just came back to serving and helping those kids with special needs in Mickey Ellis's class when I was in elementary school. And then as I got older and finishing up my undergrad, it was a no-brainer for me to go back and get my degree in special education, my master's, and it just melded beautifully to be, vocational rehabilitation, counseling, having that temperament to also, and patience to work with kids with special needs. And then that just evolved on up to being, a principal. And then again, I ended up taking off in real estate, so I never became a principal. So
how did you originally get introduced to real estate? What was that initial pivot?
You know what? That's an interesting story. I'll make it brief, but so I was married at the time and, my then wife, they had a big family reunion in Atlanta, Georgia. We were living in Mobile, at that time, Alabama. And we were going up to, Georgia, Jonesboro, Georgia. And as we are like 3 to 4, minutes away, from his house, according to the GPS, we're passing these mammoth houses. And I'm like, what does your uncle do? And she was just casually like, I don't know. And I was like, this house on the right-hand side is like on 30, 50 acres. The home has to be at least 20,000 square feet minimum. Home after home after home, the entire neighborhood. We finally get to his house and I finally get him cornered up. Now, I'm a teacher at this time in Mobile, Alabama. And I finally get him cornered up and he talks just like this. So I said, his name is Vincent Williams. I said, Vincent, yes, my boy. What do you have, my boy? And he's literally talking like, this guy talks weird. Anyway, I said, what do you do? Oh, my boy, I'm a real estate broker, my boy. And that is how that went. And I was like, real estate broker? That just wasn't things we talked about back in, you know, the early 90s, you know, from my community. You know, just what's a real estate broker? And I said, whose house is that at the corner? Come to find out, it was Evander Holyfield's house. This neighborhood was full of very, very well-to-do, multimillionaire people. And that conversation with him really made me want to go back home and figure out that transition from, you know, education over to being in real estate. And I never looked back.
And so was he in residential or in commercial real estate? He was in residential?
He did both. So residential and commercial. So he did both.
What were the next steps when you went back and you were like, I got to look into this. I got to figure out what this real estate thing is. What were your first steps to take that path?
I was a young dad, right? I was newlywed. I was a young father. And a part of that conversation with him also explored, well, when do these real estate agents work, right? Now, keep in mind, I bought my first home, but I represented myself. I bought my first home at 23 years old, but I represented myself and my family. So he was just like my boy. Of course, we worked during, you know, evenings and weekends, my boy. I was like, evenings and weekends? I'm a new husband and a new dad. Like, what can I do in real estate where I don't have to work evenings and weekends? Oh, my boy. He was real dismissive. Oh, my boy. Go get in the mortgage business, my boy. And so that's what I ended up doing. I actually entered the real estate business on the mortgage side and did extremely well. Even so well where I even became a millionaire by the time I was 27, 28 years old. When we moved to Houston, Texas, did extremely well. But then, of course, 2008 happened and we experienced a recession and my life turned on its head, just like everybody else's.
Well, I want to talk about that initial transition because you just jumped in and you're saying I did really well. I mean, what were the things that you felt set you apart or gave you the skills, the talents, the techniques to be successful at such a young age?
You know, a thing about me also, I do believe I'm a little unique. I do believe that. I was a nerd. I had a personality and I was one hell of a athlete. And so I think being a student athlete, being a great student and then being a great athlete, disciplined, and then also I think you also got to be a little stupid to try things. Don't be so conditioned. Unfortunately, and maybe for some people, fortunately, I think the more educated people are, the less likely they take chances. Sometimes you got to not be so you and be a little stupid enough to try, if that makes sense.
It does. But also, wait a minute. I don't think we talked about the sports thing. What sports did you play?
So I played football and from 4 or 5 years old all the way, you know, through high school, got a football scholarship. I played at Troy State University is what it was called then. Now it's Troy University because it's Division I. It was 1AA when I was there. And I played up until my sophomore year. And then me and my wife got pregnant because she didn't do it by herself. And and I walked away from the sport and got my bachelor's, got my master's, and the rest is history there.
Well, how was it transitioning out of football? Because that's one of the things that people, especially when you're really good at something and you identify with it, and if you'd been playing since 4 or 5, was that a tough transition?
It really,
you know, having to step away from football?
I did football as a community thing, a sport. I loved it. I excelled at it. But again, I also was a nerd. I also was a great student. And so, and I knew that, you know, I wasn't some 6'3" freak of nature. I'm 5'9" and I was fast as hell, you know, and I was good at my position as wide receiver. But I always knew that I wasn't going to the NFL but I enjoyed the game, the mindset, the mentality that came with that. And I just transitioned that over to the way I live my life and the way I, you know, confront business and people, team sport and preparation and discipline focus. And so it wasn't difficult for me. I just channeled everything into education and finished up, my studies and went to the next stage and phase of my life.
Wow, that's great to hear, because oftentimes, and I know for myself, when I stopped playing basketball and I started playing rugby after that, but it was one of those things where because I was good at it, I kept going back to the well. When things weren't working out in life or challenge, I could always go to the basketball court or, you know, find rugby game, which is kind of weird to say, actually. But go find those places and get my confidence back. So I'm like, okay, I'm not doing well in this, but I would go back to there. So to hear that you had a seamless transition in a lot of ways out of the sport, that's nice. That's refreshing to hear.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, I'm a bit multifaceted. You appear to be the same way. I see the guitars in the back. But when you start talking about being really honest with yourself, I think I'm one that could be very raw and honest with me. I have beautiful dialogue with Bobby, right? And so with that being said, you know, and then having the very, very, I was so lucky as a kid to have my parents, my mom and dad. I was so lucky with the community that we grew up in. It was almost like Candyland where I grew up. And so I was very lucky. So I was very aware of who I am, what I'm capable of. And I think that was a significant, foundation that I had. And it really set me off the right way in life. So I'm very comfortable with who I am, my skin, who I am, where I'm going. And I make pivots without looking back.
That's great. So let's go back to what you said about 2008, because Yes. The true test is when things hit the fan. And 2008 is when you're working in the mortgage business and things hit the fan. Indeed. Tell me about that situation and your experience and how you dealt with it.
Man, wow. I'll start by saying this. I ended up getting approached by an agent to co-author a book with Brian Tracy. And the title of that book was called The Ultimate Success Guide. And I was one of several authors, so I wrote one chapter and I wrote about that experience. And the title of my chapter was Evolve or Die. And it was an experience that I've never had in my life, because I feel like I didn't do anything wrong, that this cloud just came and slapped me off this pedestal that I was on. I had the house in the Galleria, River Oaks, one of the most prominent neighborhoods in Houston, Texas. You had the life, the cars, the stuff that came with that. And you had a business that was strong. And it felt like somebody walked up and turned off your lights. And there was nothing you could do about it. No bill that you could pay. That you just had to go through your lights being. And it felt like it was infinite, because you weren't given a due date of when things were going to get better. I'm trying to paint that vivid picture, because that's how it felt. I had a big cushion in my bank account, but my monthly fixed expenses took chunks out of that every month. So I'm watching money and income stop. It didn't slow down. It stopped. Banks were imploding. Going out of business, nobody was buying, everybody was holding on. And my fixed expenses were significant. So month over month, I'm watching chunks, tens of thousands of dollars, just debit, 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 and there were no credits coming out of that account. And that was a nightmare to watch because it was like you couldn't do anything about it. So then I had to start selling everything. But then here's the problem. Nobody was buying because everybody in that socioeconomic group was all trying to hold on to their shit. It was an interesting time, but I slowly downgraded everything and tried to get to a manageable point so I didn't burn all of my capital I had in my savings account. At this point, I'm not married. I'm a single father, so I'm raising my two kids. And I had to keep them in the area where they were zoned to the school where they used to could walk around the corner from the house. So I had to go get an apartment. So you're going through this process of mentally having anything that you want, anything that you can go get. You could just about walk in and swipe your card and you have it. To now, you have to start counting and paying attention and being aware. And it is not about you because I also have kids. I'm a single dad. And I got to keep my kids at their school because what's important to them is their friends. So I'm trying my best not to change their lifestyle. Don't know how well I did at that. I think I did okay, but it was a process that I wouldn't wish on anybody. I think I came out okay. There's a lot of people who came out far worse than I did.
How old were your kids at this time?
So my daughter was in the sixth grade. My son was in the eighth grade.
So. When you talk about the things that you had to deal with your relationship with, the stuff that you had to deal with, that attachment to it, because even though you're like, it was hard, but were there lessons that you took from that or that you learned from that you carry to this day? So or is it just all the heartache? All just like, no, well, all bad.
You have to reflect. You have to reflect on it. But a lot of things. I think that the two biggest things that I learned is, number one, I understand why. I'm trying to figure out how to say this without sounding like some person who just, you know, was sitting on their high horse. But I understand why people with money buy certain things because it's valuable enough to sell. It's an asset when you need it. We have to be mindful of what we buy. And does it have value? You get what I'm saying? And so if at a later date you need to liquidate, you have art, you have, you know, jewelry, you have, you know, certain types of cars, you know, classics or whatever that you could liquidate. I real estate, right? And then the other thing is, and especially now how I function, is to keep my expenses low. I talked about my fixed expenses. I was expenses heavy then, and now I'm very lean after that experience. And that's how I live my life now, because that was a moment that taught me be lean moving forward.
Yeah. Well, that's a great lesson to learn. And it sucks that you had to learn at such a scale, such an enormous rate. But I mean, I tell you from my experience, not having a lot, I was like, and then going into debt while not having a lot too, it was like, man, this sucks. I don't want to. So I never really got to the big expenses piece. So it's been easier for me to not need that or really want that in a lot of ways, but a great, great lesson to learn. Okay. So after this time you're dealing with that, your kids, you know, you try to keep them stable. So what, and the situation stable, what was the next move after that? When you figured, okay, this something else has to change here. Was there a pivot, or did you just jump back in and do it a different way?
So again, I took a year off. Like I took a year off and I went into my own personal laboratory. You know, they don't say it that way in Alabama. They just say laboratory, but, you know, I went to my own personal laboratory and while my kids were at school during the day, I was locked in and This is a great question because at that time, I was trying to figure out how are people, whenever this nightmare ends, this recession, how are they going to come out on the other side of it? What's going to be the PTSD moment, right? And how is that going to impact real estate? Because I'm in the space. And so I started exploring ideas and doing a ton of research. And that led me to come back from the mortgage business after that 1 year of research. And I ended up being on the real estate side. And I opened up a brokerage with a close friend and fraternity brother. His name is Lalu Yemington. And we had this idea very similar to what Redfin launched with. Actually, at that time, I think maybe just a year or two earlier than us, but very similar, slightly different method and approach. But that's the closest idea to they had. And I didn't even hear about them until we started talking and launching and this, that, and the other. And that's when some people said, you know, this is very, very similar to Redfin. And so that is what happened. Doing a ton of research, start exploring and testing different brokerage models, a brokerage model that we believed that coming out of this hell of a recession that everybody was handed, that there was going to be a consumer who wanted more control, more transparency and savings when it comes to their real estate transaction.
Let's dive deeper into this because I believe this is well before DOS, right? Well before. But as you're saying this, I can kind of see the evolution of how you think and how you did. So I want to talk about this entrepreneurial spirit and the process of research and then implementing and then more research and then adjusting and doing all those things. What was that like? Because as you're saying that and you're like, oh, well, Redfin has this thing. You're like, oh, well, ours is different in this way. Walk me through that entrepreneurial journey that you've experienced.
Yeah, it took some, it took being bold. It took being confident in what you believe. And I arrived at that belief through that research. And then designing a business, you know, plan and method and approach around that belief. And I say that because this model involved buyer rebates. This model involved, you know, 1% listings. And this is 2008-09. I remember we got it was October 2008 when we secured the LLC, and the company was called iBuy Realty. And we launched it and immediately went under attack by the real estate industry, especially the local agents and brokers here in Houston. What are you doing? You're ruining our industry. You're discounting. You're a discount brokerage. You're offering rebates. What the heck are you doing? You're messing up the industry. And you know, and I remember Lalu saying to me before we launched, who was already the broker. I wasn't a broker. I was just an agent with all this research. And I remember him saying, you do realize what we're about to do, don't you? And after we launched and we got the backlash, you know, I said, well, there it goes. But I stood firm and I believed in what we were doing. And here's the crazy part, without getting ahead of it, but probably I'm sure we're going to come back, is that here we go in 2024 of you know, August, and Inera went through this lawsuit, DOJ, the class action that actually signed off on exactly what I believed back in 2008 to 2024. It took that long for the blueprint of what we believed: consumer transparency, consumer choice, right? Flexibility in fees, options, without an industry who's setting standard pricing. It is an issue when you have every realtor in the country, 1.5, 1.6 million of them, saying the same price. That's price fixing. And so our idea, our hunch, that research during that 1 year proved to be exactly where we should be. But our idea was too early. And that's not the first idea that was too early. And we'll get there.
Yeah. So it's funny that when you say all these people are saying, what are you doing? You're ruining the industry. And meanwhile, throughout 2008, like, I'm ruining the industry. Yeah, look at what just happened. Like, how am I the one that did all this? That's funny to hear. So you're doing this and you're proving, but also to your point, because you've been working in the industry and the mortgage industry and, you know, then on the real estate side, and you had these assumptions, you're doing this research. Were there things that you saw behind the curtain that gave you more ammunition? I won't say ammunition, more energy to like, where this is happening. This is on the right. Not just the pushback from certain people, because I know that's important too. When you know certain established people are getting a little squirrely, you know, like you're doing something, whether it's right or wrong, you'll figure that out. But were there other things that you saw behind the curtain that you were like, yeah, there's a huge opportunity here?
You know, what's interesting about that question, there's probably the best accelerator on the planet. It's called Y Combinator. And one of the questions Y Combinator asks is, what do you know that everybody else don't know? And I hear your question and it makes me think of that. The thing was, I came from the money side. I came from the mortgage side over to the real estate side. And exactly what happened with real estate had already happened to mortgage, right? To some degree, they democratized to a level, the mortgage business. I was like, this is bound to happen in real estate. And it did. I assumed that years ago, before it happened on the real estate side. And so, but also I operated in the industry with an outsider insider mentality. I wasn't so saturated in the problem to where I couldn't see the solution. I kept a major consumer hat on my head although I was a practitioner at the same time, but I was a practitioner attempting to understand it better. I needed to understand the intricacies of it, but I still wore a consumer hat. So I didn't have a distorted view or perspective of the business, if that makes sense. And I had absolutely zero desire to protect the status quo. I was a consumer champ. And so maintaining that position allowed me to see this big blue abyss called real estate. It allowed me to see it differently. And I think that is what became and still is my superpower in this business.
On the technology side, because a big part of what you do and what you focus on is the technology. Tell me about your early involvement in learning about tech and doing the research and building your platform. And again, I don't want to be jump steps here, but that for me is like, because I see how much you're involved in on the technology piece of this and your platform. When did that become more of a focus of yours?
So it kind of just happened. So again, I'm a bit of a nerd. So I am a fan of Jeopardy. So I'm watching Jeopardy. We are in the middle of this recession and it's 2011. And I caught wind that IBM and some super computer they created called Watson is going to be on the show against the two winningest players in Jeopardy history. I was like, oh, I got to watch this. I don't care what's going on. I am stopping the world and I'm going to pay attention to this IBM. What is it? This Watson thing? Play the two winningest players in Jeopardy history? Don't bother me. And so I chime in. And I'm watching it, and it's just buzzing, answer. And I'm like, get the heck out of here. And I was just curious. But then I caught the bug because I asked myself this question, what if I could do that for real estate? This is in 2011. We got to keep in mind, there is no Amazon Alexa at this time. There is no Google Assistant. ChatGPT wasn't even a thought. IBM Watson was the first intelligent assistant. And that idea stuck with me. And then all of a sudden, I had to, once again, I go back in the laboratory and I'm trying to do all the research on Watson, intelligent assistants, smart computing. And it took me way back to the 50s, interesting enough. Some of the smartest minds, I was reading their books. I needed to understand how they were thinking when they were creating and developing these ideas. And they're not much different from today. As a matter of fact, if you were to go read these publications, you would think that they just wrote them this week, this month. But this was in the 50s and 60s. But IBM was still early. It hadn't even hit commercial level yet for them to monetize it yet. But then all of a sudden, 2013 came, and I ended up being on his first class flight with this gentleman. And we're flying from Dallas to Houston. And this is how the universe works. And I'm sitting next to the guy, and it's one of those, so what do you do? What do you do conversations? Because we're both in first class, right? And I'm like, well, you know, I have a company called iBuy Realty, and I'm doing a lot of research on converting it from a traditional brokerage over to a technology company. He said, oh, tell me more. So I tell him, and he said, get out. He said, I said, well, what do you do? He said, I work for IBM Watson. I was like, get out. Next thing you know, he tells me, I'm coming from New York, right? You know, and we're looking for use cases. As soon as we land, you need to go home and you need to pull up this website and you need to submit your idea. I said, man, I'm the wrong guy to tell that that's happening. The minute I dropped my luggage at home, I did exactly that. He gave me his business card. I stayed in touch. I submitted my use case and I waited and I waited and I waited. And then next thing you know, it's 2015 and I get that phone call. Didn't recognize the number, but it was a 512 number. I know that's Austin, Texas. I answered, Bobby speaking. Hi, this is Amy with IBM Watson. I'm like, okay, we got your use case. And you know what? We really love your idea, this, that, and the other, blah, 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 blah. And we would like to welcome you to IBM Watson. I said, are you serious? And she says, yes, I'm serious. She tells me everything. We're going to give you two boxes of APIs and tech tools, and we're going to put some engineers and developers around you to help you develop this MVP. And I'm going to send you an email. I'm going to verify it. Yes, great. She sent me the email. I hung up. I ran out the office and screamed like a little kid on Christmas down the street. That's how we kicked this thing off.
You took a first class flight from Dallas to Houston. How long is the flight? I got more questions for you, but
45 minutes. So both he and I both were coming from other places. It just flew to Dallas and then to Houston.
Okay.
When you come from the East Coast, everything goes through Dallas. Right.
Yeah,
just like we fly that way. Everything either stops in Dallas or Atlanta if you're going further, right, east. So it's the way the airplanes and the airports work.
Well, I think back to you were like, yeah, I used to spend all this money, but apparently you're still spending that money, but it worked out. I mean, if you got a first class that's amazing. Yeah. So that's amazing that you actually got sat next to this person that you've been talking. And so when you did that, like, what was your experience going through that? Did they really put those engineers and everything? Like, what was that experience and how'd that support what you were doing?
It was refreshing. It was powerful. It was insightful. It was early, right? They did. They actually, you know, I had to go kick off with a small tech team. They gave us all of these tech tools and they were learning. So they also were learning. So they kind of gave us this treasure trove of APIs and said, go work on it. And, you know, our engineers and developers will work alongside with you. And it was so insightful and intriguing for them because they needed to see it with different use cases. That's why they did this. And we put together a powerful MVP and we had to do a demo for them with their tech and our idea. They absolutely loved it. After that, we entered into a written agreement with IBM. We didn't even know what we were going to call it. And so if you remember DOS, the disk operating system back in the day, we were pandering to IBM with our name. And so we added another S and changed the acronym to Dynamic On-Demand Software System. Because we were like, we're working with IBM. This is what's going to happen. And they love everything. They invited me and my team to Austin, to what they call the garage, which is where they build stuff and solve problems. And we had to present in front of their garage to the engineers because they were trying to rally around us. Like, and they were asking us, how did you do this? And we were like, this is your tech, right? You know, so it was interesting to have to explain stuff to them, but they were trying to also understand and solve problems because of other ideas and other, you know, companies and startups. But that was the evolution of that. And then all of a sudden in 2020, kind of fast, you know, forward.
Well, it's funny you say all of a sudden, but then that's like 7 years. Yeah. So was that process like 5 to 7 years to really?
So from 2015 to about, yeah, up 2015 to about 2017, we were working on it and working on it, and we were trying to raise capital. And then we were also, you know, pitching investors, but it was so early. And then in 2020, they let Jenny Rometty go, who was the current CEO. IBM, I guess, was losing so much money with their bet on Watson to the point they started dismantling it and selling off IP. So now we're kind of sitting idle in the water, like, well, what do we do now? And so that created another pivot with our company. And next thing you know, Google came knocking.
Hmm. But before that, all that happened, IBM was very, you'd say they were very, very helpful in everything that you were doing?
Yeah. Extremely. I think I actually still even believe that if IBM and Watson would have continued, you know, I can't imagine. I think they forfeited a significant lead. But I'm not at the boardroom at the table. But it was a very powerful product, and we created a really, really cool solution that was so cool. It scared the shit out of a lot of people in the industry because nobody ever seen it. We practically pioneered, was a leader when it comes to real estate intelligent assistant or an intelligent assistant in the real estate space. We were the first to launch such a thing. And even now, if you go to YouTube and look at the demo, it's still amazing today, even though now we're in an AI agent world.
And so when you mentioned that then Google came knocking, you were pitching, how did that come to be? How did you find out about the Google, is it accelerator, an incubator?
Yeah, accelerator. So what happened was, is, you know, we were a part of Mass Challenge Accelerator. We were part of Generator Accelerator as well. Some really, really good accelerators that teach, you know, founders about, you know, doing your pitch deck correctly, you know, how to pitch. You know, you got a chance to see other startups, you know, their temperament, what they were working on. But in that, you started learning about other, you know, other accelerators that were looking, you know, for some really good, you know, startups to come be a part of. And that's the beautiful thing about those accelerators, is you meet other people, right? Other startups that can kind of catapult you in other rooms and arenas. And that did that for us. And we came across some people at Google and were asked to submit our information. And we did that and got accepted into the accelerator, which is a blue chip accelerator as well. It's a really, really great experience for us.
That's great to hear. But, and as you're doing this, so how is this all getting funded at the time? Did you have investors through these accelerators and incubators, or were you actually making capital on the business model itself?
So great question. So we were very fortunate. You know, I'm very fortunate to have friends and fraternity brothers who invested into the company at a family and friends round. We raised like $1.8 million, which is significant for a startup. I mean, we were getting great traction, a lot of publicity, a lot of big stages, And so we amazed 1.8 million. We were not generating revenue until 2020, you know, after COVID. So you're talking about for 4 years, it was just capital raised and learning, trying to develop, build on tools today that would be considered prehistoric, right? It was technology was evolving at such a rapid pace. Everything that we built then is laughable now, but it was built on the foundation of that, right? You know, but we did. We raised significant family and friends money to showcase it, to build it, to bring in developers, not to mention MLS data, because again, we're a prop tech startup. You start talking about MLS data, the other data feeds, it's very expensive and very clunky. Right now that you think about it, so I understand the reason why the barrier of entry into the space is so low because of the cost.
Yeah.
Right, so, yeah.
So now you enter Google and they're doing it. What were some of the differences that you saw working with them versus any of the other organizations that you worked with previously?
Man, Google, the support, the way they rally around you, your team, the training, they have people, right? It's different than when you go to an accelerator and you may just have these 4 or 5 people. And then they bring in guest speakers and this, that, and the other. Google has the resources to literally wrap heaven and earth around you, right? That's priceless. As long as you are a student, and just like anything else, as long as you know how to access your access, right? Because you have access, but you have to mobilize it and be forthcoming. And I'm that way. I will engage and extract, everything I can out of an opportunity. And I did that. So much so, it ended up leading to us getting into a second Google Accelerator. And then eventually, Google invested $100,000 into our company through a Google, the Google Founders Fund.
So when AI comes about, you got Google. I'm assuming this is around the same time, like AI starting to come out, or were you already accepted to the accelerator for the AI started to become a common household concept?
It surely wasn't, you're right. It surely wasn't what it is today, right? And Google was, had dialogue flow and all these other, APIs and stuff like that. It still is chatbot-ish, right? Not true AI. Now, it might have had some sprinkles of, some stuff in it, but it was a chatbot, which is significantly different now than what an AI agent is, right? And so, but yeah, they have some tools that you just couldn't get anywhere else because they were Google. And a lot of what their APIs were and are, it is perfect for our use case in real estate.
And so that being said, the pivot now and the company that shall not be named, but there's been a significant shift or pivot in your business model. Can you share with me and the listeners, the viewers, what can you share with us about this next phase of what you're doing?
You almost have to start with where we were. The company DOS was a beautiful, beautiful idea. But once again, we were too early. The technology today is far more advanced, and exactly today what we, needed and wanted. But then also the model then included us, as I said earlier, expensive data, the MLS data. And the reality with that, we were really, if we're honest with ourselves and my team, and at essence, we weren't building nothing but a sexy feature, conversational AI. And the reason why I say that is because DOS was going, it was building and it was using MLS data, and a user could, speak, text, or type any question about any property to get, easy, accurate, and instant answers. And don't get me wrong, that was great at that time. But there were two forces that was rapidly evolving and going through a process at the same time. That's the real estate industry, number one. And then on the other side of it, it was the tech industry. The real estate industry, again, as we said earlier, was getting sued because of, you know, the way it structured its commissions, you know, agent negotiating, price fixing by the DOJ. They were right in the middle of that. And then at the same time, this rapid evolution with technology and you know, ChatGPT came in November of 2022 and just gave it to Google and Amazon. I even ask you right now, when the last time you've seen an Amazon Alexa commercial? You haven't. Now, Google did a great job at recovering. So all of this was happening in our world, and it was like we were right in the middle of it. It felt like a Final Destination movie. Thank God we survived. But on the other side of it, and this pivot and this direction, after the dust has finally settled, now we have a really good idea, given that the rules and regulations have been changed and updated and pushed down and throughout the real estate industry. And now we have a good idea where tech is going. Now that we see where ChatGPT is and Gemini is, of course, they're going to continue to make some advancements. But now we're able to have this direction of going directly to the consumer. Exactly what Airbnb did. Exactly what Uber did. Exactly what Amazon did. So what are we building? It's a peer-to-peer real estate operating system that's AI-powered and all property type platform that lives beyond the MLS. It addresses the full life cycle of home ownership and expands globally without needing permission. And that's exactly the method and model that we are developing and that we plan to release here in the near future.
One of the things that you mentioned is that you're like, we have an idea of where this is going. We have an idea. And one of the things that I am acutely aware of, that an idea is not necessarily a product, and a product is not necessarily a business. Uh-huh. So as you're going through all this and you see like, yeah, this is how the cost analysis would be, like, this is how we make money through this. Is that something that this accelerator has also helped you with? Or is that something that you're like, no, this is already the platform. We know exactly how it's going to work. How much does that factor into your design of what you're building?
Yeah, you have to take, we've had a lot of beautiful conversations and we've made a lot of beautiful mistakes. And you have to take every experience and bake it and think about it, evolve it. And I mean, all from a 3D, 4D, 5D angle. And because you need to try to see this problem from everybody's perspective in every direction possible. So before there's some, you know, ChatGPT or some survey or this, that, and the other, you really have to, number one, be obsessed with the problem. If you're going to really try to solve something, you got to be obsessed with the problem. You can't have an idea or hunch. That's the reason why the problem that we're solving, or why real estate has gone more than a century without being disrupted. It's almost like they've built this moat around the industry that nobody can crack. Right? There will never be some 18, 20-year-old in some garage or in their mother's den that disrupts real estate. Because you got to have the experience. You got to have the background. You got to understand the problems. And because it's multidimensional. You look at all the rules, regs, people, agents, bureaucracy. If you don't have a good hunch, then you have to understand the tech. And then you got to understand how you're going to blend those two. And then to your question, and then how are you going to make money? Then how are you going to make money? You know, and then how does it make money for investors? And then how does, you know, so these how-tos are so, and you have to think about and have the wherewithal about all of that and being able to bring it together into something that could be special and big and mobilized and valuable and useful. So it's very interesting to the question you asked. It's such a big answer.
Yeah, and it's funny because you have that experience from, you know, the money side and then the real estate side and then the tech side. So you see it. So you see it all, right? And then you've seen the evolution. And I just imagine, like, as you're going to these accelerators and you're talking to investors, and you just have such a good understanding of it from these different viewpoints, that you can see what it is and what it could be. And then, as I'm aware, because I've been in the startup accelerators, incubators, and do these things, and people are always poking holes in it and like, well, what about this? What about that? And you're like, yeah, maybe. But at some point, if you believe in it and you're obsessed with it, like, no, this is what it is. This is how we'll make money. How much we'll make, I mean, we'll see what the margins look like, but this is the thing and this is the problem that it's solving. And from what I understand of what you're doing, it's there. And I'll say this, being at a lot of these prop tech conferences and, you know, over the years, and coming from the real estate industry, I've seen a lot of solutions without a problem, where there's tech folks that are building something that you're like, yeah, it's novel. And like you mentioned before, something may be a feature, but you're like, I don't see it. I don't see it. But then there's some things that you're like, oh my God, like I can see how that would save me a lot of time, a lot of effort. And, you know, if you're saving the time and the effort, you know, you extrapolate that over, you know, whatever critical mass, then you got money. You got your revenue.
When you say that, I've engaged in a lot of conversations where guys would come to me and ask me what I would think, which I'm honored. I never wanted to create a company that was a passenger company. And what do I mean when I say passenger company? It has to be mobilized by somebody else. I'm not creating something that I hope Zillow requires it. I'm creating something that has the potential to make something else become obsolete, right? I want a driver idea. Right? You know, Uber and Amazon doesn't need to be, right, a part of Hilton Hotels website, right? You know, Uber didn't create itself to be a widget on a cab company's website. No, they're a driver company. And when I would go to, but yet what was crazy to that point, Dustin, you might have scratched a nerve and got me on a soapbox there, but what's crazy is those are the companies that end up getting money. Those I kept noticing in my journey that's what investors are investing in, because they could turn around and not disrupt their other prop tech investments, right? By funding this passenger idea and hopefully get in it early, and then it get acquired by one of their bigger investments, and everybody wins and it just goes up, up, up. So you have driver ideas that struggle to get mobilized because it could disrupt previous investments if they are an investor who has historically invested in the space. So it's really interesting what I've seen and heard over the years, but you just have to take on that approach like Airbnb did, because if anybody understands their journey when they went to Y Combinator and Y Combinator actually attempted to change their model. And I love the fact that those founders stood their ground and said, no, we believe this. And they talk about that story. And then the then president and CEO of Y Combinator echoed this statement. I am so glad they didn't listen to us. They wouldn't be a $100 billion company today. So I tell everybody who's watching this video, listen constructively, but know when to stay firm.
I love that. And that's especially the people that are listening that are entrepreneurs, the people that are watching that are entrepreneurs, listen constructively to whatever, because everyone's going to have their ideas and things, and listen, take it in, digest it. But if it's not aligned, and also have the people around you, co-founders, partners, to, you know, is this aligned with what we're doing and where we're going? And if not, because what I've realized, nobody has the answer. even the people that have had success in the past in something or one thing or another doesn't necessarily mean they're right about everything. So I love that. Listen constructively.
Yeah. You're closer to the problem. You see the problem. Hopefully you studied the problem. Hopefully you are intimate with the problem, obsessed about that problem. So, but the question becomes, are you able to articulate that problem in a very concise manner? Because if you can't, then they're going to say, you don't understand your problem.
So before we take off for this episode, and thank you again for joining and sharing, hopefully we'll have, when you release, come back on and share more about the journey, because I know you're working on, it's really cool from what I understand. I know, I don't know all the details, but it's pretty sweet. Is there anything else that you want to leave our audience with today?
I'm reminded, as always, by one of my favorite quotes by Lady Audre Lorde. She was an activist years ago, and she had a very famous quote. And I want to share this for everybody, all of your listeners, my friends and family who are going to listen. And she had a quote that says, "If I didn't define myself for myself, I'll be crushed into people's fantasies for me and eaten alive." As you're on this journey of self-exploration, a lot of us await for somebody to speak over us and tell us who we are. And it's as though our whole life and we inhale this breath that we've been holding. People, define yourself for yourself, right? It's so easy to be derailed into somebody else's idea, direction, because you didn't define yourself for yourself. Live vicariously through you. Seek your truth. Be comfortable in your skin, because you only got one, and no matter what. And master you, because the quicker you become a master of you and your domain, actually, that's what helps you see the world half full. So that's my message for the day.
That's beautiful. And as you're explaining that, and really on the journey and of finding yourself, and you mentioned, use the word earlier in this conversation, and you said curiosity. Mm-hmm. You only mentioned it once. You only said the word once, I believe, in this conversation. Mm-hmm. But I know, from what I know of you and from what I know of some of the people that are living the fullest lives, mm-hmm. is that they have that curiosity and they have that drive, and they don't necessarily stay stagnant. They mm-hmm. follow that curiosity and learn and grow and build on the things that are led by that curiosity. And everything that you do, I mean, it seeps that, you know, like that is who you are. And it's cool. It's cool to see you have the success and all the things that you're doing. So again, congrats on your success. And I know the journey continues, but it's really fun to see you doing your thing.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate it. I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you and your audience.
And so we're going to include some places to connect with you in the show notes, but is there anything that you want to share, like where people should best find you? I know you're very active on LinkedIn, but you know, any websites or any other places they can find you?
Yeah, right now, that's what I would suggest. Go to LinkedIn, Bobby Bryant, and let's connect there. Shoot me an invite, let's chat. I'll be glad to even answer some questions. And I'm an educator at heart. So if you have a question about anything we've talked about here, please feel free to reach out. I promise to get you an answer.
All right. There you go. The fantastic Bobby Bryant. Thank you so much.